So forget about it. And he's got a Nobel Prize.
Oh, I think what you're saying is that a man's credentials doesn't guarantee that he's smart, and the lack of credentials doesn't guarantee that he's not smart. I agree with you. In fact, some people with less credentials are more motivated to try harder and do a better job. But when he went from the short circuit and diode as the output load versus the automobile light bulb and then the battery, he showed you the battery voltage increasing, but he didn't show you the current flowing into the battery. That's a little bit disappointing. He didn't tell you the voltage or the current going into the light bulb. He didn't tell you the current that was going into the short circuit. It would have been nice to have those pieces of information. But whenever you have a charged inductor and that field winding being fired by that transistor, and the transistor is being fired by the magnetic reed switch, let me drop. I call that an inductive kickback suppressor circuit. In other words, his diode into a short, diode into bulb, a diode into battery are three different kinds of inductive kickback damper circuits. You get the slowest discharge of magnetic field when the diode looks at the inductive kickback into a short circuit. It takes the most amount of time to discharge that field. The light bulb discharged the field a little bit faster because it allowed greater voltage to occur during the field discharge. And the battery, the 12-volt car battery that went to something like 12.8 volts, that gave an even greater rate of discharge of the magnetic field. So with the short circuit, the motor speed, let me drop, the motor speed, in my opinion, was being limited by the fact that the field did not get a chance to completely relax in between the on times and the off times of the transistor. There was still residual magnetic field. Therefore, you were approaching a longer duration of time of coil saturation during the time the transistor was in the closed mode. And let me backtrack on that one. It is my opinion that the reed relay and the rotating magnet on that plastic pulley on the output represent a fixed pulse duration, a fixed duty factor. There's a certain amount of on time and a certain amount of off time, which is reasonably fixed. Let me drop. So let me be ridiculous and say that it was 50% on and 50% off twice per cycle, twice per rotation. Maybe that's 75% on, 25% off, but you know what I mean. Let's assume it was 50-50, each on and off cycle. Two on-off cycles per rotation, because he was swinging by two magnets into the one reed relay, which was a reed switch, which was firing the transistor. Because the magnetic field with the short circuit damper did not get a chance to completely discharge, that magnetic field was spending a larger period of time nearly saturated during the on times of the transistor. During the time he was charging the battery, the reverse EMF, the kickback, was a larger number of volts, 12 and a fraction volts in that battery, plus another 7/10 for the diode, let's call it 13 volts. With 13 volts of inductive kickback, the coil was coming much closer to thorough discharge of its magnetic field during the transistor off time. Therefore, the average current going into that coil was less. Also, because the coil's magnetic field was going to a lower number during the time the rotating armature was trying to be released by that magnetic field, it had a greater amount of release, therefore it had the ability to spin faster. So, at first, when you look at the circuit, let me drop, when you look at the circuit naively, you would say he gets a higher rotation with less current going in when he is charging the battery. He gets more current going in with a lower rotation when he is using the short circuit. And it looks like he has found some energy. I'm not convinced. I see a explanation with the duty factor of charge and discharge being essentially fixed and the amount of voltage that's allowed during the inductive kickback. If, for instance, I'm putting a diode protection circuit across my magnetic relay, that's my transmit-receive relay, let me drop. I would put a diode across it in order to make sure that the inductive kickback was not 1,000 volts and it wiped out my driving transistor to that transmit-receive relay. I'd put a diode across it. If instead of putting a diode, back EMF diode, I used a Zener diode, so that with the right kind of a Zener in series with a an ordinary diode, so that now during discharge, it's not an open circuit where it goes to 1,000 volts and wipes out my transistor, but the Zener allows it to go to 50 volts. My relay will now drop out much faster, and that's somewhat similar to what he's doing with that field excitation of that magnetic motor. That's the way I see it, Wesley. I wonder if you see it differently. N2XJN, K2LIW.
K2KEY, can I ask you a very important question?
Okay, go ahead.
Hey, I want to know if this violates a law. Many years ago, there was an article when transistors were in their infancy. It had an article that you build this little transistor radio, but you don't need no power. You pick up a local broadcast station, and it powered the radio. Not only you didn't have to listen to that station, but you can listen to other stations, but the power source for the radio was tuned. You tuned this little section with one little variable and coil to a local strong broadcast station, and that powered the radio with no external, no batteries needed. Now, was I violating any kind of laws, Dick, by doing that over?
Well, when you say laws, were you violating a legal law? Absolutely not. Were you violating the laws of physics? Absolutely not. All modern-day RFID tags behave in that manner. Your RFID tag will have considerably greater sensitivity, and your reader of the 96-bit code from that tag, in most circumstances, will have a greater range. If somebody is operating a cell phone a few feet away from that RFID tag, the cell phone, even though it's on the wrong frequency, will be charging the rectifier network and capacitor that's part of that tag's operating circuit. And that's somewhat what you were doing, Mel. Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, now, I was rectifying, I was getting the tuned circuit, picking up this local broadcast station, and rectifying it, and making it work this radio. Of course, current drain is very minute. If I put up several antennas, I was able to put up, say, a bunch of beverage antennas, long wires, whatever, and I did that, I rectified, I kept, you know, paralleling up the circuit so I could rectify and charge batteries or whatever. What happens? Am I getting something for nothing, Dick? Over.
I say you're getting something for nothing, and I say it's perfectly legal. You didn't request that that radio signal cross your property line and go onto your property. Once that radio signal is on your property line, from my point of view, as long as you're doing something reasonable with it, you own it. And if you want to put up a very high gain array antenna on your property to suck up a whole lot of that signal of a local broadcast station, and you rectify it, and you run the light bulbs in your house, or you run the radios in your television house, and whatever, that is your choice. There's a catch, though. If you now start taking a programming that entered your property that you didn't request, which was encoded because it was a pay-per-view service, and now you start charging admission for your neighbors to come watch that pay-per-view service, or you start shipping it with wiring over to your neighbor's house, and you charge him for it, now you've entered the realm of theft of service. But in the case of standard over-the-air broadcast, that signal that entered your property, if you want to rectify it, as I see it, you own it, Mel. Over you, Mel.
It's a while.
Hey, no, I want to know that. I would like to know if I had a setup like that and I can get enough parallel antenna system, a larger enough array, and I'm taking all these local broadcast stations with all this power that's coming here, AM broadcasters or whatever, and I want to rectify it and charge my batteries or run my light bulbs or whatever you want to call it, Dick. I just wanted to know, am I violating any kind of law? Am I sucking energy or whatever? Because wouldn't I be getting something for nothing, over?
Without a doubt, you're getting something for nothing. But it's not huge. Under normal circumstances, you're only going to get milliwatts out of that. You're not going to get a kilowatt and run all the light bulbs in your house and the electric burner on the stove and whatever. It's just not that much energy there. And if you worry about the fact that you're stealing radio energy that would normally go to your neighbors, if your neighbors are also in that strong signal area, you can't possibly steal enough to affect whether or not they get normal reception. And if you're worried about affecting the reception 50 miles away in your direction, very unlikely. First of all, from that broadcast station to your direction is out over the open water of Manhattan Beach and out over to the Atlantic Ocean. Second of all, in the far field, what you do up close has an extremely minor perturbation. Now, you're not violating the laws. Bernie wanted to say something. KQIO, go ahead.
Actually, Dick, you just answered my question. I had a curiosity question. If Mel's array was large enough that he could get a useful amount of power from that signal, would I, as his next-door neighbor, notice a lack of my signal? Because you already answered that question. Thank you.
Because he's getting such a whopping big signal that he can rectify it and run a transistor radio off of it, that means the signal getting to his property is probably, I'm going to pick a number, 75 decibels in signal strength above threshold for his receiver. His next door neighbor is also getting a signal 75 decibels above threshold. Mel puts up this huge antenna, gathers as much energy as he can. The next door neighbor, instead of getting 75 dB over threshold, is going to get 70 dB above threshold. He's still way into the compression of the automatic gain control circuit of the receiver of that neighbor. No problem. So up close, where the signals are so strong, without careful laboratory measurements, you'll never know it. 50 miles in that direction, he's not even making a dent in that signal. Because of the way radio signals propagate around obstacles, and his antenna represents a kind of a skeleton obstacle, 50 miles in that direction, they wouldn't be able to measure the difference before and after when he did his experiment. Let me drop. Because the variation from day to day, because of the way the ionosphere behaves, can make a 20 decibel change in signal strength. The ionosphere can do that. And what Mel does 50 miles away is going to make a tenth of a decibel of difference. So you got a tenth of a decibel of variation riding on top of a 20 decibel random variable. Without doing the experiment 1,000 times, you'd never be able to confirm it. You see where I'm going on for that one, Bernie?
Absolutely. I was just wondering, taking Mel's question out to an extrapolated next question of would it be violating a law of nature of getting something for nothing? To Mel, yes, you're getting something for nothing, but the guy with the transmitter is giving you that something for nothing. So the I can't think of what it's called now. The law of equilibrium? No. I don't know. My physics professor would shoot me, but I've forgotten what it's called. But there's no, there's nothing gained or lost in that transaction, at least as I see it.
Yeah, there's no free lunch here. Law of conservation of energy. The energy that Mel's getting, which is in the vicinity of milliwatts, started off as many kilowatts of energy at the broadcast station. And Mel's tapping into a couple of milliwatts of the original multiple kilowatts of transmission. So, he's a flea on the back of an elephant, if you know what I mean. He's not making a very big dent in the operation of that broadcast station. Yeah? With a good laboratory scale, you can measure the fact that that flea is now on that elephant. But it takes a pretty careful measurement to be sure. Now, getting back to Wesley's latest set of, well, at least some of the emails you mailed me, the latest email, with some of those websites, I think I see an explanation for why with the larger voltage of the damper circuits going from short toward bulb toward battery, I can see how the coil went into greater discharge in a shorter period of time. That in itself allowed the armature to run at a faster rate, because it was going into a greater amount of release, and because the field is spending less time in saturation, the total current drawn from the 20-volt power supply was lower. So although it's an extremely interesting experiment, I see a mechanism by which it is not demonstrating free energy. Over to you, Wesley, N2XJN, K2RIW.
K2RIW, N2XJN. Well, let me put generally something, because it is something that actually I have to express. Whether in most of the circuits of this kind, the resonant frequency is turned back into the battery power. Now, we might state, whether it's true or not, that somebody say, I know it works. Question is, why does the world not use it? At the same time, it's really unfortunate that I didn't have a chance to go into the Marco Rodin work, because at that point this coil actually also represents the over-unity factor, but in different way. Let me put it in general form. Let me jump for a moment. His work actually was the concentration energy in the donut shape form circuitry. And there is nothing to prove it. It just exists, and hundreds of people actually repeat that. It's a number of video clips explaining that it works. The same story is with the example that I have sent you over the video, I mean the video clips, that there are hundreds, if not thousands of people who actually claim, and they are not stupid people. Some of these video clips are even smarter than the original one. But to all who claim that perpetual motion is possible, I pose a question. If it's so impossible, how is it that every planet in our solar system maintains rotation seamlessly under their own power? I understand you can oppose that. Also, comets and meteors keep moving through the space on their own. Also, as I mentioned, the Newtonian principle dedicates that objects in motion stay in motion unless acted upon the other force. So, as I mentioned, it sounds for me like a perpetual motion. Basically, if an object is in motion, or the electron is in motion, whatever you say, it should continue to move forever unless it's acted against by another force. Planet Earth itself is a big magnet, and the motion here are the subject for this force. If the same is done in the space, then I would say that let's say you have a fuel cell. Because I'm relating exactly to that, but in different way, and I understand that you try to understand my words. If you have a fuel cell, two electrodes, water, you have any kind of sodium, whatever, and then hydrogen is created, there is also an ion of plasma energy. Then if you excite the water with 3 minutes, let's say, charge, and leave the negative on, the electrons continue to drain. It should not, but they do. This creates ion plasma energy as well as HHO. This energy looks like it is over unity, just splitting to atoms. And also, as I mentioned, the atoms contain from the particles, and these particles constantly spin by itself. So if you look skeptic way on there of a new unity factor or over the perpetual motion factor, you may also find the way that was unexplained. You got to understand that these videos are limited with the time and space. Now, let me go back to the subject. I'm not saying that the law of thermodynamics is false, and I'm not saying that it was created this way, but if inside every atom itself there is a motion that goes against the law, and there is a constant spin with no input energy, no entropy, and it still puts electromagnetic energy, the electrons are in perpetual motion. So, if you take another another energy, that was the polymer electrolyte membrane, PEM, that was used in Apollo rover 1969. This kind of device also used the factors of over unity, although it was made for the certain spin of light. There was Coleman, I don't remember, PM and the cells. The resonant frequency was also turned back to the power, to the battery power. If you take another thing, the aluminium air battery, if you know something about it, aluminium air battery. You first apply electrolysis to two atoms of H and two atoms of oxygen. Then you oxidize the aluminum, which generates energy. I have the whole chemical formula. I'm not going to go into it. But I spent much time studying physics and chemistry just from the different perspective. And let's say 1 kilogram of aluminium costs, let's say, $1.50. It contains approximately 56 megajoules, which comes to 15.5 kilowatts. And then you get 2.57 kilograms per liter, so the liter of aluminium contains 144 megajoules, which comes to, let's say, 29.8 kilowatts, which is available from the battery to run, let's say, an electric car with super efficiency. The Tesla goes 200 miles for 56 megajoules, a gal, let's say, of gas, which costs $2.50, and contains 120 megajoules in 20% of efficiency of an engine. My understanding is that there must be some mechanism that is out of science that is actually preventing from certain things to be proven and properly researched. Do you understand what I'm mentioning, Dick, and to exist?
I think I do. I think you're looking for the hidden energy, the possibility of free energy, the possibility of excess energy on each of those experiments. The one that I'm best able to address right now, though, Wesley, is your last email to me, which was on Thursday last at 10:23 p.m. And of the email, of the website you gave me, the last three websites, I think, are all Mr. Peter Lindman. And you started off the three of those by saying, what is my opinion, has scientific value, is, and you listed the three. The second one you said is the most interesting, and the third one you said has motor inside. And as I see it, when he had the short circuit for the discharge, assuming the diode was ideal, and no voltage was appearing across the short circuit, you could say the power output was zero. And at that time, the motor was drawing a little bit more than 1 ampere at 20 volts. 20 watts was going in, and you could say the output across the short circuit was close to 0 watts. If I jump to the third one, let me drop. If I jump to the third email, again, he had exactly 20 volts going into the motor, and the current went down to something close to 200 milliamps, so a little bit more. A little bit more than 4 watts was going in, He showed us the 12-volt battery being charged, but he didn't tell us the current. It's possible the battery was being charged at the rate of 3 watts. So 4 watts going into the motor, 3 watts coming out charging the battery, might have been the operating conditions of that last movie, the last website. And so he showed you the 12-volt battery going from 12.4 to 12.7 volts. You could tell it was being charged, but there was no ammeter on that battery. You don't know the rate at which it was being charged. And a fraction of an ampere into a car battery would act that way. So there's missing information by which we can't tell. We know that the needles were moving in the right direction as he used the three different loads, but we don't know if the final result was a desirable one. And after all of his years of experimenting, if the final result was not a desirable one, if that was true, then it's hard to say whether or not he has hit success yet. N2XJN, K2LIW.
You were looking at the clip named 2B. There are quite few clips of that gentleman who actually put that and experimented with it. So what you don't see on that particular video, did you look all of these videos, or just look for this particular one that I have sent you that I found that would be the most explaining one? And this is not the one from the beginning of. He experimented with, I believe there was five clips that I saw of him. And only this one I have sent you, as I see. Back to you, Sergeant.
In your last email to me, you listed a total of 6 website addresses. I looked at all 6, and the last 3 are the ones that you said, in my opinion, has the most scientific value. I concentrated on the last 3 that you said has the most scientific value, and those are the ones that I was just talking about. Now back to you, Wesley, K2LIW.
Okay. What is in my opinion, yes, there are 3 of them only. There are 3 of them only out of 6 or 8 altogether. I do not remember, I saw thousands of video clips. I do not remember exactly the contents of it. But if we state only based on what is available from these video clips that I have mentioned to you, you might be right. I remember that I saw the replication of the same circuitry from many other people, and even more interesting than this one. But this one had one thing that the others didn't have. That table, tablet, that tablet, and he actually put himself into the position that he started to analyze. And did you actually follow when he was putting all of these numbers on the table, on the tablet? Back to you, Antoine.
I sure did, and that's what I'm now addressing. He had a felt tip pen whiteboard, and he wrote down the 3 conditions. He wrote down the RPM of the motor, measured with a tachometer. He measured the primary current going in from the 12-volt supply, and he told you whether or not, when he loads down the rotator by putting his hand on it, whether or not the current changed substantially. And the answer in all 3 cases was essentially no. So, yes, he had a whiteboard, and he wrote down all 3 conditions, all the conditions for all 3 setups, for short circuit, automobile light bulb, and 12-volt battery. He didn't tell you how many volts were on the light bulb. He didn't tell you how many amps are going into the car battery. He didn't tell you how many amps are going into the short circuit. I didn't need the amps into the short circuit, because the watts are going to be 0, because the volt is 0. So there's a primary major piece of missing information on his tablet, which doesn't allow you to close the loop. I speculated as to what was the... I know what the input wattage is, considering the rate at which his car battery was being charged. I've charged car batteries. I've watched them. Let me drop. I charge car batteries at various current inputs while looking at the battery voltage with a 4.5-digit digital voltmeter. I think his was a 3.5-digit. Doesn't matter. I've seen the rate at which the voltage on a car battery increases when you put in 150, 200 milliamps, 1 amp, and whatever. And so with the information I can speculate, which I think is the current going into the car battery, which is his best condition, and he didn't tell me. And what I saw, I'm not yet getting enough information to know whether or not his power output was better than the power input. All I can see is the rate at which things were changing as he went to the three conditions with and without hand loading on the rotating wheel, and that's not enough information. And when you look at the comments that other people have made about Peter Lindemann, they're also complaining that there's always a little bit of missing information where you can't close the loop, and that makes them skeptical. N2XJM, K2LIW.
N2XJM. Well, I was also skeptical. I was trying to read every possible comment that was on this video clips. I can count right now that Energy Forum guy has 49 videos. 49 videos of him. I remember that I went at least 15 of them. And I found that from all of the explanation or from other people that I was seeing, this guy would put much effort to explain. And you might be right. You might be right. But the thing is that what I have to do is just look at the clips that were not included. I did not even expect, Dick, that you're going to pay attention to that. With the hundreds of the emails that you're getting from other people, I just put that in kind of frustration that actually there was a three video clips that I sent it. Let me go to that. I said that the three clips has no scientific value. It is not important if it works as much as it's important how inconvenient it is if it really works, or how catastrophic it is if it works. That was my frustration, that a person like you, at the beginning of our discussion, was disqualifying the subject without even looking at it. So I put myself in the position, okay, I'm going to just to attract your attention into it. And I start...
Repeater, time out.
And I've got your attraction. Now what you're going to do is just systematically go with your logic and try to answer this question. For now, I do not have the answer. Yes, you're right. We have a missing pieces of the puzzle. And I have to find out whether I would be able to get to the results of yours, or maybe I would be ensuring myself that this really works. One of the things that I would like to take to your attention is that everything that were invented and eventually presented did not have the mathematical explanation. I very much respect Eric, not Eric, there was, not Eric. I'm getting tired. Forget it. I'm gonna, who said that, all of the mathematical formulas, no matter how complicated, usually with all of the pattern application, comes to very, very simple mathematical equation. Now, the only guy that I have met with all of these shocking true or untrue stories that actually mathematically explain everything, the rules behind the experimentation, is just the last guy that I mentioned today, which is Marco Rodin. And what happened is everything starts to change. People from different kind of science start to look at it. And people, they are interested with electronics and the flow of electrons, or everything start to build by themselves his coil. Now, there is none of the people criticizing his invention. You cannot find, at least I could not find, it is not long time that I studied it. You could not find any negative opinion about this guy or his invention or his way of thinking. And you cannot find one guy who experimented with that or who put the comment who would say this is a baloney. Back to the Andalusia.
KQRIW here. I'm going to agree that some of the better patents have a word description, and it would be nice to have the mathematics, but the mathematics wasn't there, and it still was a good patent. So the lack of mathematics does not create an invalidity of a good patent application. In the case of these three videos at the end of your last email to me, which you said, what in my opinion has scientific value is, and you listed the three, the third one is the most exciting one. That's the one where he's putting in 12 volts at a little bit more than 200 milliamps and getting back out of the rectifier on the inductive kickback, he may have been getting an average current of 250 milliamps, even though he's putting in 200. But the 200 milliamps of input was at 20 volts. I'm going to speculate the 250 milliamps of output was at 12 volts. So possibly the power output is smaller than the power input, and although as he was changing from his various loads, things were moving in the right direction, he didn't yet have more out than in. So it wasn't yet in the blue, in the black. He's still operating in the red, if you know what I mean. A negative ledger, not a positive ledger yet. The gross input to output. Let me drop. And so the fact that he's not using an output current meter and not telling us what the output current is one thing to worry about. Second of all, the transistor is going on and off into an inductor. Therefore, the current waveform really is a stepped waveform from the 20-volt supply. He is reading that with a averaging Dawson Val movement. He's not reading the true RMS of input current. So even if the mathematics, if he told me the output current and it worked correctly, the next thing we have to worry about is that a Dawson Val movement always gives you average indication, not true RMS. So there still would be a question, even if he gave me the missing information. A triplet or a Simpson Dawson Val movement meter does a beautiful job of telling you a steady state current. He didn't have a steady state current. He's telling me the average of the current, not his true RMS. And the same thing, the voltage wasn't changing, so there's no problem there. So for at least two reasons, we haven't yet closed the loop. If you could find a website where all of the input information and all of the output information is present in the display, and then he puts it on the whiteboard, the tablet, that would be beautiful. Over to you, Wesley, K2RIW.
KQRIW intention. Well, I'm going to try to do this. I'm going to try to follow the methods and methodics in order to just explain even to myself the questions that you have. But actually, as of now, I do not have an answer. I don't. I got to look at this video again. I got to find the related videos. I'm going to carefully look what eventually I can find, send it to you, and if you have a time to look at it, that would be great. But I believe when you get involved with Marco Rodin, you're going to be so much consumed, at least I believe, the person with open mind like you. And it's basically it. That coil is actually I might say the due to the central circle of the wire, it naturally creates a gently increased magnetic field in the center of the torus or the donut comparing to the conventional coil. So whenever we have a question about over unity and we're dealing with the Tesla squirrel cage and we're dealing with the neodymium magnet, one question that passed through my mind, where is that over unity coming from? That's the first. And the second, what is exactly the point of their over unity? Back to you, Dick, and to exchange.
Repeater, time out.
He turned it over right at the announcement of timeout. You're saying you don't have the full answer yet, and that's acceptable. You're still in the research mode. I understand that. And there's still missing ingredients. By the way, I guess I'll start looking for articles by Marcos Rodin. And I do remember in the past seeing articles about a toroidal magnetic field that is put into an explosive chamber, which in a very small number of microseconds collapses the coil and gets out a huge amount of voltage and current for a brief period of time to operate very special kinds of defensive or offensive electronics. I'm somewhat familiar with those techniques, slightly familiar. I'm going to have to run along, and so more to follow. We'll eventually gain more of this. I accept the fact that you don't have the full answer yet, obvious by the fact that there's not one running in your QTH in Queens right now. Once you find the right one, and for a man of your resources, you're going to want to have one. You're going to want to touch it, feel it, watch it work, and look at all that power output. That's obvious. I'm going to have to go for now, Mel, Wesley. And by the way, I think you were trying to think of Glenn's name, KC2QIQ. We'll have more discussions during the week. 73 for now. K2RIW listening.
That is correct, Glenn. Yes. Either I'm getting old or I'm getting tired. I was actually spending most of the day trying to concentrate on Rodin's invention. And there are so many things, so much exciting in it. And I'm going to send you a few videos and also a few websites where you can find more information about it. And then I would be very happy if you can discuss that. Now, as far as the antenna, I believe if I have any way to contact you, well, I can do it over the internet. I have a circuitry that might sound for you unreal, but if that actually make some sense, I would appreciate if you say something about it, and then eventually experiment with that. Back to you, Antosia.
Understand, and I'll be looking forward to that. I'll be looking for that emailing. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you very much, Dick. I'm very sorry that I kept you so long, and I do appreciate your time and your patience to me, especially with my limited ability to express myself in English. And, I feel bad about about keeping you so long.
I'll survive. Bye-bye.
Good night, Dick. K2KEY. Very interesting. And next time I see you, I want to see the little engine.
You and me both, Mel. And the first working model is going to be on Dover Street, isn't it?
I'd love to build one. Just give me the schematic.
You can go to his website now and buy his plans, but that might be a little premature. Let's wait until we see something with a little bit more closed circuit, if you know what I mean. I gotta go. Bye-bye.
We'll talk about it further. Take care, guys.
SYL clear. Please note that this is an extended Amateur Radio Newsline newscast with breaks at 9:40, 19, and 25 minutes and 50 seconds. Total running time, 34 minutes, beginning now.
Amateur Radio Newsline, report number 1,696, with a release date of Friday, February 12, 2010, to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. Ham radio relief communications continue in Haiti. A UK publisher gives financial support to the RSGB's fight against BPL. A major sunspot appears on the surface of the solar disk. A radio prank brings a $16,000 fine. And a teen finds a way to send radio waves through solid rock. Find out the details on Amateur Radio Newsline. Report number 1,696, coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, here is this week's report.
Amateur Radio's effort to assist in earthquake-ravaged Haiti continues to expand. Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, is in the newsroom with more.
The role being played by radio amateurs in post-quake relief efforts in Haiti is far from over. This with word through the ARL that Doug Lapin, K10Y, and the Dominican Radio Club's team returned there earlier this past week to install another repeater which will serve as a major upgrade to the overall system. There are two fixed sites at the Dominican Embassy and at the UN Logistics Base. The system was primarily to be used by the Dominican Red Cross. Lapin and the Dominican group were to be in Haiti for 2 days and hope to come back next week to upgrade the power plant. Lapin says that he also attended a recent United Nations weekly status meeting where he was deluged with requests by the UN and others to use the network.
The time is
he knows that there are still severe communications problems in Haiti, especially as more aid organizations get organized.
Repeaters.
Meantime, Julio Rapol, WD4R, reports that the University of Miami's hospital amateur radio team have been very busy passing messages between Florida, the hospital ship Concord, and around the airport in Haiti. He notes that the University of Miami's hospital hams have also been put to work repairing radio and medical equipment for other relief groups. Rapol notes that the landline communications are still down and that cell phone service is only about 80%. As said for Paul, the cell phone service is really only in the immediate area of the main airport. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ICF, in the newsroom in the City of Angels.
With Haiti's communications infrastructure still in a state of disarray, it appears that ham radio will play an important role in rescue radio efforts for months to come. Meantime, to assist the Mars Communications Support Effort in earthquake relief to Haiti, the heads of Army, Air Force, and Navy Marine Corps Mars have agreed to divvy up responsibilities among the three Mars programs. In a report carried by the ARRL, Air Force Mars Public Information Officer David Trachtenberg, N4WWL, said that the delegation of responsibility will facilitate more efficient utilization of Mars Communications assets in the overall relief operation. The January 12th earthquake wiped out the island nation's communications infrastructure. A partial list of hams believed to have been active from Haiti prior to the January earthquake has surfaced. Amateur Radio Newsline's Don Wilbanks, AE5DW, has the calls to listen for.
According to a posting from KC8VWM, the following stations represent known Haitian nationals who are hams, who have been operating stations in Haiti in the past year or so. They are HH2AW, HH2DMJ, HH2DZ, HH2GM, HH2FJM, HH2JR, HH5HK, HH3AR, HH6JH, HH2B, and HH2LX. There may be others, but if they are, they've not been heard on the air in a long time. Charles adds that some of these call signs may have expired and some hams may have relocated to other countries. Also, latest reports indicate none of these stations listed in Haiti have yet been contacted.
At airtime, nothing more is known about the health and welfare of anyone on this list. In other Haiti earthquake relief news, some free radios are on their way to Haiti to help the general public know more about humanitarian efforts coming their way. Jim Damron, N8TMW, has the details.
The humanitarian organization Ears to Our World has launched an initiative to distribute a substantial number of Eaton Corporation donated radios to individuals in remote and impoverished areas of that nation. These are wind-up generator-powered radios, which also have a built-in flashlight. The group believes that the radios could provide life-saving medical and food water supply information to families and communities. The organization is currently raising funds to help pay the expedited shipping costs and perhaps allocate even more radios for a future shipment. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Jim Damron, NATMW, reporting.
The initial shipment of over 100 of these self-powered radios was to be sent to Haiti this last week. PW Publishing, the company that owns United Kingdom magazines Practical Wireless and Radio User, has joined the BPL fight. This as it becomes the first corporate donor to the Radio Society of Great Britain's Spectrum Defense Fund. The company has also generously given the RSGB advertising space throughout the year to highlight the problems of broadband over power line interference. A possible turning point in the high-frequency propagation doldrums, this as spaceweather.com reports the sudden emergence of sunspot 1045, which in turn has caused a sharp increase in solar activity. The active region appeared on Saturday, February 6th. By midweek, it had produced 3 M-class and almost a dozen C-class solar flares. The strongest blast, an M6-class eruption on February 7th, may have hurled a coronal mass ejection toward Earth. Whether or not sunspot 1045 is a precursor to ongoing improved solar activity or just a one-time occurrence remains to be seen. Sample sounds and images may be found at spaceweather.com. 3 people have been named as recipients of the ARRL's 2009 Bill Leonard W2SKE Professional Media Award. First up in the audio category is radio host Ted Randall, WB8PUM, of the weekly QSO radio show. The ARRL Board of Directors recognized that Randall's show has become even more effective as a podcast of consistently high quality in its treatment of issues within amateur radio week after week. Ted was the recipient of this award in 2008 as well. In the area of video, the award was given to reporter Kim Burns of Kansas City television station WDAF. She covered the Raytown Amateur Radio Club's 2009 field day operation for her station's Sunday morning news magazine. Burns also provided reports on the diverse aspects of amateur radio, specifically highlighting ham radio as a hobby, as an emergency communications service, and as a radio sport. She also chronicled the evolution of two-way radio technology with what the board called a fascinating video report. Lastly, the Print Journalism Award was given to Vicki Taylor, who is a reporter for the Chambersburg, Pennsylvania newspaper, Public Opinion. She was honored for her coverage of the licensing of 8-year-old Victoria Latham, KB3 SSM, and her 7-year-old sister, Veronica, KB3SSN. This was the heartwarming story of how these two preteens convinced their dad, Shannon, W3SML, and mom, Rachel, KB3RNP, that they were ready to get their ham tickets. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the N7BGS repeater serving Star Valley, Wyoming. A New York radio station that played what has been described as a distasteful radio prank on a listener has been issued a proposed fine of $16,000 by the FCC. But it's not what was said that got the station in trouble, but the way it tried to circumvent the FCC rules that say a person being recorded during a call must be advised before the station rolls tape. Amateur Radio Newsline's Bruce Tennant, K6PZW, picks up the story from here.
In its notice of apparent liability for forfeiture against WSKQ Licensing Incorporated, the regulatory agency says it's proposing to assess this $16,000 fine because of WSKQ's apparent willful and repeated violation of Section 73.1206 of the Commission's rules. This, by broadcasting a telephone conversation without giving prior notice to the individual being called of its intention to do so. On August 23, 2007, the FCC's Enforcement Bureau received a complaint citing that a station employee made a call to a woman claiming to be an employee of a local hospital. The caller told the recipient of the call that her husband had been seriously injured in a motorcycle accident and that he died at the hospital. The complaint also alleged that the call recipient became distraught when she received this information. Thereafter, the station employee informed her that the call was nothing more than a joke. Based on the complaint, the FCC issued a letter of inquiry to WSKQ Licensing on September 25, 2008. In its response, WSKQ Licensing stated that its parent company, Spanish Broadcasting System Incorporated, contracted with a vendor, Ruben Ithier, who recorded the call for a prank call feature show. It admitted that Ithier initiated the call broadcast by the station. It went on to claim that the call was made at the call recipient's husband's request and that Ithier performed the prank. WSKQ Licensing did admit that Ruben Ithier did not inform the call recipient that the call was being recorded for later broadcast until after the call had been recorded and played over the air. The licensee provided a transcript of the program, the content of which confirmed that the call recipient was not given notice that it was being recorded for future broadcast. The licensee also admitted that the station broadcast the call twice on August 23, 2007. WSKQ Licensing also included a recording and a transcript of this broadcast. We have read it and find it far too distasteful to repeat. It does, however, indicate that the prank call recipient hung up the phone when she learned the call was a prank. Also that Ruben Ithier telephoned her again to obtain a permission to broadcast the call. In its February 4th decision to issue the proposed fine, the FCC did not touch on the content of the prank call. Rather, its concern was the fact that the call was recorded and replayed without the consent of the recipient. As such, the FCC concluded under the procedure that WSKQ Licensing used in producing this broadcast that it is apparently liable for the willful and repeated violation of Section 73.1206 and liable for a $16,000 fine. The Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bruce Tennant, K6PZW in Los Angeles.
As is customary, the FCC has given the station's owners 30 days to pay the $16,000 fine or file an appeal. The FCC is in the process of making permanent the rules governing the Vanity Call Sign program. As regular listeners are aware, late last year the FCC issued a notice of proposed rulemaking titled WT Docket 09-209, that seeks to amend the Commission's Amateur Radio Service rules. This to clarify certain rules and codify existing procedures governing the Vanity Call Sign system, as well as revise certain rules applicable to club stations. Now, interested parties may make comments on this notice of proposed rulemaking via the federal e-rulemaking portal or the FCC's own website. Comments must be submitted by March 26, 2010,